Blog Talk Radio. Breaking news, it's July 16th, 2018. Dorothy?
Breaking news number one, Cozy FAA inspector let infractions slide by Kate O'Connor. A government report says a longtime FAA inspector allowed unqualified pilots to fly for the United States' largest airline. The report issued by the Office of the Inspector General, OIG, for the Department of Transportation, says that the 28-year veteran seems to have been affected by his relationship with American Airlines. The safety concerns, which only involve maintenance verification flights, not any flights carrying passengers, were originally brought to the FAA by the Allied Pilots Association, as known as APA. After APA reported that its concerns had gone largely unanswered for about 18 months, the Inspector General's office stepped in to audit the FAA's effectiveness in addressing this issue. See more on newsletter Jan-June 2018.
Okay, Mike? Breaking news number two. American, JetBlue, and Southwest bid for Delta's former Cuba route by David Allison, editor of Atlanta Business Chronicle. Three U.S. airlines, American, JetBlue, and Southwest, are bidding to take over a route to Cuba that's being abandoned by Delta Airlines Incorporated in May. In May, Delta, NYSE Dallas, said it would determine or terminated service to Havana, Cuba from JFK Airport in New York on September 1st. Delta has said back to in December that it would dramatically reduce flights to Cuba from JFK International just over a year from the launching from launching them. Delta cited U.S. government policies that have resulted in lower demand for travel to Cuba from areas outside of South Florida. See more in the newsletter January-June 2018.
Breaking news number three. New York-London is the world's first billion-dollar airline route by Dan Reed of the Computer. A British Airways jet taxis at New York JFK Airport with the city skyline barely visible in the distance. British Airways route between Kennedy Airport and London's Heathrow Airport route is the first route to produce more than $1 billion in revenue in a 12-month period. For the first time in history, one airline has brought in more than $1 billion from just one very highly traveled and pricey route. British Airways took in a record of more than $1,037,724,000 from flying passengers between London and New York in a 12-month period from April 1st, 2017 through March 31st, 2018. You can see more of this in the newsletter January to June 2018. Over to you, Chuck.
Breaking news number four, VR pilot tech now includes a touchy by Mary Grundy. Virtual reality systems for flight simulation now includes haptic capabilities, simulating a sense of touch when interacting with a virtual environment. U.S. companies flying side partnered with the GoTouch VR startup based in France to develop the system for market, introduced last month at a trade show in France. This haptic solution would be adopted for pilot training. GoTouch VR said in a news release, the technology is realistic, flexible, scalable, and affordable, the company said. The advantage for pilot training is that the VR system costs much less than simulators, but the haptic capabilities that were approaching the same level of experience. See more in newsletter Jan-June 2018.
Hello, Eastern family. It's great having you with us. My name is Jim Hart, and I'm coming to you from the beautiful island of Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. Today was a beautiful day here, probably high of about 78 to 80 degrees. But you see, we're right along the water on the south coast of Massachusetts. Along with our other hosts at different locations, we want to welcome and thank you for listening and calling this show. You have truly made us the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. We'd love to hear your comments and share your memories with radio listeners from around the world during our broadcast. If you haven't called the show before, all you have to do is call 213-816-1611 and just say, howdy, to talk with us on the air live. We can identify many countries around the world who listen in with our Blog Talk Radio application. Isn't it great that we can keep the Eager Eastern legacy going out to not only the Eastern family, but to listeners from many different countries around the world? And that's why we what we try to do every week. And on the EAL radio show, won't you join us by adding your voice to these broadcasts? We'd love to hear from you. Our thanks also to those who choose to listen by computer using the radio icon on our homepage at www.ealradioshow.com, or perhaps by signing in at the site of our provider, Blog Talk Radio, at www.blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie. Should you wish to talk during our live broadcast, let me repeat the number so you can write it down for your Monday night visit. Here it is, 213-816-1611. Please tell your friends about us. And don't forget, you can listen to any of our 370 Monday night broadcasts and 60 Thursday broadcasts by simply going to blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie and scrolling down through the archive broadcasts. Each episode is briefly described. Our lines are always open for calls, and if you choose not to participate and talk live with your host, we ask you to please mute your phone, as our producer does not have the capability of filtering out any background noises. Now, Mr. Producer, I see you're number one in the lineup for takeoff from Atlanta Hartsfield Jackson International Airport. So let's get flight episode 374 in the air.
Eastern 374, the winds are from the east at 5 to 10 miles per hour. You're cleared for takeoff, runway 9 left.
Roger, Eastern 374 is on the roll.
Thank you. each minute. As the day goes by, feel yourself in it. It's a good day to up and fly away. It's so easy to do. Easton's got the right time.
Obviously, research regarding technological unemployment is as vital today as further refinement or production of labor-saving and comfort-giving devices. Among all the marvels of modern invention, that with which I am most concerned is, of course, air transportation. Flying is perhaps the most dramatic of recent scientific attainments. In the brief span of 30-odd years, the world has seen an inventor's dream, first materialized by the Wright brothers at Kitty Hawk, become an everyday actuality. Perhaps I'm prejudiced, but to me it seems that no other phase of modern progress contrives to maintain such a brimming measure of romance and beauty coupled with utility as does aviation. Within itself, this industry embraces many of those scientific accomplishments which yesterday seemed fantastic impossibilities. The pilot, winging his way above the Earth at 200 miles an hour, talks by radio telephone to ground stations or to other planes in the air. In thick weather, he is guided by radio beam and receives detailed reports of conditions ahead, gleaned through special instruments and new methods of meteorological calculations. He sits behind engines, the reliability of which, measured by yardsticks of the past, is all but unbelievable. I myself still fly a WASP motor, which has carried me over the North Atlantic, part of the Pacific, to and from Mexico City, and many times across this continent. Aviation, this young modern giant, exemplifies the possible relationship of women and the creations of science. Although women as yet have not taken full advantage of its use and benefits, air travel is as available to them as to men.
Amelia Mary Earhart was an aviation pioneer who became the first woman to fly solo across the Atlantic. She set many solo flying records and wrote several successful books about her experiences. She was a supporter of equal rights for women and saw her role to inspire other women and give them confidence that they could achieve the same as men. In 1937, aged just 40 years old, Amelia Earhart disappeared over the Pacific Ocean on a solo flight attempting to circumnavigate the globe.
The most difficult thing is the decision to act. The rest is merely tenacity. The fears are paper tigers. You can do anything you decide to do. You can act to change and control your life, and the procedure, the process, is its own reward.
Amelia Earhart was born in Atchison, Kansas. Her father was a lawyer and her grandfather a former federal judge and a leading citizen of Atchison. From an early age, Amelia displayed a great sense of adventure and was often referred to as a tomboy. She enjoyed pursuits not common for girls of her age, such as shooting rats with a rifle, climbing trees, and keeping wildlife such as worms and a tree toad. Her mother encouraged a greater freedom for her children that wasn't common for the time. Her mother once commented that she didn't believe in bringing up her children to be nice little girls. The spirit of relative freedom and adventure was a common trait throughout her life. In 1909, Amelia and her sister joined her parents in Des Moines, Iowa, where her father was now working for the railroad company. Unfortunately, her father was diagnosed as an alcoholic, and later he lost his job. In 1915, the family moved to St. Paul, Minnesota, before shortly having to move again on to Chicago. Chuck.
In her young years, Amelia was educated at home. She was a keen reader, kept a scrapbook of women who had made significant achievements in the field that were at the time primarily reserved to men. After moving to Chicago, Amelia tried to find a school with good science teaching, but she was disappointed by what they had to offer. Her education proved a disappointment. 1917, she trained as a nurse and began volunteer work at Hispania Military Hospital for wounded soldiers from the Western Front. In 1918, she contracted the Spanish flu while working as a nurse in Toronto. It took her a year to recover and left her with a chronic sinusitis, which adversely affected her flying. Jim, hold her.
Fascinated her by flying, and she developed a deep-seated desire to fly.
I did not understand it at the time, but I believe that little red airplane said something to me as it swished by.
On December the 28th, 1920, she had a first flight with pilot Frank Hawk. She said,
"By the time I had got 200 or 300 feet off the ground, I knew I had to fly."
Working in a variety of jobs, Amelia saved up money to be able to pay for flying lessons. 1921, with the help of her parents, she was able to receive flying lessons from Anita Snook, a pioneer female pilot. By 1923, Amelia was the 16th woman to be issued a pilot's license. By 1927, she had accumulated 500 solo flying hours, and it was quite an achievement given the rudimentary state of early aviation. A pilot had to be good with manual control, but also apt in the navigation and securing a safe flying route.
In 1931, she married George Putnam, though she insisted on equal responsibilities in marriage and kept her own name. In a letter to her husband, she wrote,
"I want you to understand I shall not hold you to any medieval code of faithfulness to me, nor shall I consider myself bound to you similarly."
Together they had no children, but George had two children from a former marriage. In 1927, Charles Lindbergh became the first person to fly solo across the Atlantic. Shortly after, Amy Phelps Guest offered to sponsor a female who might be willing to undertake that flight. In 1928, she accompanied pilot Wilmer Schultz on a 20-hour flight across the Atlantic to England. This flight received a significant deal of media attention and made Amelia a public figure. She was sometimes referred to as Lady Lindy. This led to profitable marketing opportunities with a company called Lucky Strike. Her newfound image enabled her to become involved in the design of female fashion, focusing on simple, natural lines which were practical to wear. Her image as a successful pilot also played a role in raising the profile of air travel for ordinary people. In the 1930s, the real beginning of commercial air travel. Shortly after her first flight across the Atlantic, she set out to make her own several untarnished air flights on her own. She became the first woman to make a solo transatlantic flight on May 21, 1932, flying from Newfoundland to a field in Clonmore, north of Derry.
She also used her image to support women's groups, especially women's groups dedicated to flying, such as the 99s. She became friendly with Eleanor Roosevelt, who shared a similar outlook on human rights and female equality. With support from Purdue University, Earhart began plans to make a challenging 29,000-mile global flight around the equator. It would not be first flight to transverse the globe, but it would be the longest staying close to the equator. She had a Lockheed Electra 10E built to her specifications. For part of the flight, she would be joined by Fred Noonan, an experienced navigator. By late June 1937, Earhart and Noonan had traveled from Miami to Southeast Asia and Ley, New Guinea. On July 2nd, they took off from Ley intended to go to Howland Island. However, on their approach to Howland Island, there were radio messages that they were running low on fuel. Contact was lost, and the plane never made it to their destination. Despite an extensive search for the plane, they couldn't be found, and they were presumed dead in absentia. In a letter to her husband shortly before the final fatal flight, she wrote,
"Please know I am quite aware of the hazard. I want to do it because I want to do it. Women must try to do things as men have tried. When they fail, their failure must be but a challenge to others."
The most widely accepted theory is that they ran out of fuel and had to ditch the airplane in the sea. Others claim they may have made it to Phoenix Island. Now, here are some of the achievements of Amelia Earhart. First female to fly solo from Hawaii to California, January 11, 1935. First female to fly solo across the Atlantic, May 21, 1932. Inspired a generation of female pilots to take up a domain primarily reserved for men. Women's Air Force service pilots who helped in World War II. Women's world altitude record of 14,000 feet, that in 1922. First woman to fly the Atlantic, 1928. Speed records for 100 kilomiles or kilometers, 1931. First woman to fly an autogyro, 1931. Altitude record for autogyros, 15,000 feet, 1931. First person to cross the U.S. in an autogyro, 1932. First woman to fly the Atlantic solo, 1932. First woman to fly the Atlantic twice, 1932. First woman to receive the Distinguished Flying Cross, 1932, and I'd have to read up on that one. First woman to fly nonstop coast-to-coast across the U.S., 1933. Woman speed transcontinental record, 1933. First person to fly solo between Honolulu, Hawaii, and Oakland, California, 1935. First person to fly solo from Los Angeles, California, to Mexico City, 1935. First person to fly solo nonstop from Mexico City, Mexico to Newark, New Jersey, 1935. Speed record for east-west flight from Oakland, California to Honolulu, Hawaii, 1937. President Herbert Hoover presented Earhart with a gold medal from the National Geographic Society. Congress rewarded a Distinguished Flying Cross, the first ever given to a woman. I still got to look that up. Citation, Python, T-Van, Amelia Earhart Biography, Oxford, UK, www.biography, online.net, 11th February 2013, last updated March 1st, 2018.
Jim Holder. Here are 15 fascinating facts about Amelia Earhart by Amanda Green, dated July 24, 2017. Amelia Earhart was a pioneer, a legend, and a mystery. To celebrate what would be her 120th birthday, we've uncovered 15 things you might not know about the groundbreaking aviator. Number one, the first time she saw an airplane, she wasn't really impressed. In Last Flight, a collection of diary entries published posthumously, Earhart recalled feeling unmoved by a thing of rusty wire and wood at the Iowa State Fair in 1908. It wasn't until years later that she discovered her passion for aviation when she worked as a nurse's aide at Toronto's Spadina Military Hospital. She and some friends would spend time at hangars and flying fields talking to pilots and watching aerial shows. Earhart didn't actually get on a plane herself until 1920, and even then she was just a passenger. Colleen.
Number two, she was a good student with no patience for school. After working with the Voluntary Aid Detachment in Toronto, Earhart took pre-med classes at Columbia University in 1919. She made good grades but dropped out after just a year. Earhart re-enrolled at Columbia in 1925 and left school again. She took summer classes at Harvard but gave up on higher education for good after she didn't get a scholarship to MIT. Number three, another pioneering female aviator taught Earhart how to fly. Netta Snook was the first woman to run her own aviation business and commercial airfield. She gave Earhart flying lessons at Kinner Field near Long Beach, California in 1921, reportedly charging $1 in Liberty bonds for every minute they spent in the air. Chuck?
Number four, Earhart bought her first plane within 6 months of her first flying lessons. She named it the Canary. The used yellow Kenner air starter biplane was second one ever built. Earhart paid $2,000 for it, despite Snook's opinion that it was underpowered, overpriced, and too difficult for a beginner to land. Amy Earhart encouraged her daughter's passion. Her father, on the other hand, was afraid of flying. Earhart's mom used some of her inheritance to pay for the Canary. She was a bit of an adventurer herself, the first woman to ever climb Pikes Peak in Colorado.
Number six, Earhart had a lot of odd jobs. In addition to volunteering as a nurse's aide, Earhart also worked early jobs as a telephone operator and tutor. Earhart was a social worker at Denison House in Boston when she was invited to fly across the Atlantic for the first time as a passenger in 1928. At the height of her career, Earhart spent time making speeches, writing articles, and providing career counseling at Purdue University's Department of Aeronautics in Ohio and flying around the world. Number seven, she wasn't sure about marriage, but she definitely believed in prenups. When a promoter, George Putnam, contracted Earhart about flying across the Atlantic Ocean in 1928, it was her first big break and the beginning of her love story. The two began working relationship, which soon turned into attraction. When Putnam's marriage to Dorothy Binney fell apart, he eventually proposed to Earhart. She said yes, but reluctantly. Earhart wasn't worried about safeguarding financial assets, though, as much as she wanted them to maintain separate identities. Earhart asked Putnam to agree to a trial marriage. If they weren't happy after a year, they'd be free to go their separate ways and no hard feelings. He agreed. They lived happily until her disappearance.
Number 8, she wrote about flying for Cosmopolitan. In 1928, Earhart was appointed Cosmopolitan's aviation editor. Her 16 published articles, among them, Shall You Let Your Daughter Fly? And Why Are Women Afraid to Fly? Recounted her adventures and encouraged other women to fly, even if they just did so commercially. Commercial flights date back to 1914, but they wouldn't really take off until after World War II. 9. First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt was so inspired by Earhart that she signed up for flying lessons. The two became friends in 1932. Roosevelt got a student permit and a physical examination, but never followed through with her plan.
Number 10, Earhart was the first woman to get a pilot's license from the National Aeronautics Association. Then it was called the NAA. That was back in 1923, when pilots and aircraft weren't legally required to be licensed. Earhart was the 16th woman to get licensed by the Federal Aeronautics International, FAI, which was required to set flight records. Still, the FAI didn't maintain women's records until 1928. She accomplished a lot of firsts. Earhart eventually became the first woman to fly across the Atlantic as a passenger in 1928, and then solo in 1932, and nonstop from coast to coast in 1932 as a pilot. She also set records. Earhart was the first person to ever fly solo from Honolulu to Oakland, Los Angeles to Mexico City, and Mexico City to Newark. All of that in 1935. What do John Glenn, George H.W. Bush, and Amelia Earhart have in common? Well, they all earn an Air Force Distinguished Flying Cross, but only Earhart was the first woman and one of the few civilians to do so. Jim.
Number 12. She was one of the first celebrities to launch a clothing line. Amelia Earhart's fashions were affordable, separate, sold exclusively at Macy's and Marshall Field's. The line's dresses, blouses, pants, suits, and hats were made of cotton and parachute silk and featured aviation-inspired details like propeller-shaped buttons. Earhart studied sewing as a girl and actually made her own samples. Number 13. The U.S. government spent $4 million on the search for Amelia Earhart. At the time, it was the most expensive air and sea search in history. Earhart's plane disappeared on July 2, 1937. Official search ended a little over 2 weeks later on July 19th. Putnam then financed a private search, chartering boats to the Phoenix Islands, Christmas Island, Fanning Island, Gilbert Island, and the Marshall Islands. Chuck?
Number 14, search isn't over. There were several theories about what happened to Earhart's plane during her last flight. Most people believe she ran out of fuel and crashed in the Pacific Ocean. Others believe she landed on an island and died of thirst, starvation, injury, or at the hands of the Japanese soldiers in Saipan. On 1970, one man even claimed that Earhart was alive, well, and living in a secret life in New Jersey. International Group of the Historic Aircraft Recovery has explored the theory that Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan, lived as castaways before dying on Gardner Island, now called Nunumarora, in the Western Pacific. Over the years, they found few potential artifacts, including the evidence of a campfire site, pieces of plexiglass, an empty jar of the brand of freckle cream that Earhart used. Early July 2017, a photo surfaced, and it seemed to confirm the theory that Earhart and Noonan crashed and were captured by a Japanese soldier. But that photo was quickly debunked. Mike?
Yes, number 15. Today, another Amelia Earhart is making history. In 2014, another pilot named Amelia Earhart took off to the skies to set a world record. The then 31-year-old California native became the youngest woman to fly 24,300 miles around the world in a single-engine plane. Her namesake never completed the journey, but the younger Earhart landed safely in Oakland on July 11, 2014. We think lucky Lady Lindy would be proud. Okay, George is not on. We found this article appearing in June 1933 newsletter of Eastern Air Transport, Newswing's newsletter, along with pictures of Amelia Earhart and Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt. It reads, "Nation's hostess flies as Amelia Earhart's guest." Displaying again her love for flying, Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt made a night flight over Washington and Baltimore in a 1933 Curtiss Condor of Eastern Air Transport. She and her party were the guests of Amelia Earhart Putnam, including Mr. G. Hall Roosevelt, the First Lady's brother, George Palmer Putnam, publisher, and Mr. and Mrs. Eugene Vidal, and Thomas B. Doe, president of Eastern Air Transport. Taking off from Washington Airport, the airliner climbed through the skies to 5,000 feet. Amelia Earhart left her distinguished guests in the cabin and took the plane's controls, flying it to Baltimore. She returned to the cabin then, and Mr. and Mrs. Roosevelt sat beside the pilot as he circled the Baltimore and turned again towards Washington. It was looking like down on the top of the world, the nation's hostess declared. Washington was marvelously beautiful from the air at night, and Baltimore was so huge beneath our wings it was an inspiring sight. Once before, Mrs. Roosevelt had made a pleasure flight at night in a Curtiss Condor of Eastern Air Transport. At that time, was over New York, and she declared that it was like a trip through a fairyland. Her Washington-Baltimore flight was in the new 1933-type Condor, in which engineering features had included, which make it the first quiet liner of the air, having a noise level of 75 decibels, the same as a Pullman car. The crew was composed of chief pilot E.H. Parker, co-pilot Earl Steele, and flying hostess Edwina Davis. Mrs. Roosevelt made 11 flight trips via Eastern Air Transport. In 1937, Eastern Air Transport became a model aircraft flown by Amelia Earhart on her last flight, the Lockheed Electra 10, retired, and 8 DC-3s were added to the fleet. Captain John Gill and co-pilot Vern Patterson set a DC-3 world record between New York and Miami with a stop in Charleston, time 6 hours and 2 minutes. In 1937, Dick Merrill and Jack Lambie made an around-the-world Atlantic crossing that year. Captain Eddie Rickenbacker started an effort to buy Eastern Airlines.
Great discussion, folks, about Amelia Earhart. 81 years ago, was it 81? Let's see, 37. Yeah, 81 years ago, she disappeared off radar. Of course, we didn't have radar back in those days, but still searching. And anyone know any late breaking news about discovering the Earhart crew?
I haven't heard.
Well, I saw the photograph they were talked about where she was sitting on a. Looked like a pier from
right.
a distance. And it looked okay to me, but I did not know until the night that it was debunked. How did they debunk it? Anybody know?
I don't.
That's the first time I heard it. I've seen the picture probably half a dozen times.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Put it under a magnifying glass and everything. It's pretty close.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you. That's the first I've heard that it was not true.
It was supposed to have, somebody mentioned that it was had been taken prior to the flight rather than afterwards.
Is that what it was?
I mean, there was a lot of controversy over it, so who really knows what's the real scoop on it?
But she wasn't in Saipan before that, was she? Before her flight?
I don't think she was.
March of this year, 2018, Emery Martinelli, my technical advisor here, just flashed on my smartphone that the bones were discovered on a Pacific island in 1940 are likely to be those of famed pilot Amelia Earhart, according to a U.S. peer-reviewed science journal. I don't know whether that's fake news or what.
Well, I don't know, but if the bones were her, wouldn't that indicate that she actually did land there or was brought there or swam there? Whatever the case might be.
They had bones. They must have DNA.
It was March of this year.
Well, maybe they can do the DNA bit, but I don't know where they get DNA from her prior to 1937.
Yeah.
Well, supposedly they're able to do that from what I understand.
Yeah.
They could take DNA samples from her hair that's in her brush at home if they have it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but was DNA used back then? Would they have thought to do that?
No, you would have to go to some museum or something that would have her comb or hairbrush or something with hair fibers in it. And then you would take the hair fibers and you would try to match it up with the bone structure for DNA.
Yeah.
That was in
March,
so maybe they're doing that research.
Yeah, it sounds pretty simple by this day and age, and if there was anything that was positive on it, I'm sure that we would have all heard about it by now.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it says here further in this article that Emery showed me, but a new study published in Forensic Anthropology claims these bones prove she died as an island castaway, and the report claims they are 99% match. Contradicting an earlier conclusion.
Yeah.
Well, that's very
99% match of what?
I don't know. It doesn't say that here. That's why it leads me to believe it might be fake news.
And she'd have to have some sort of a hairbrush that was left all those years from when she first combed her hair. So how is that likely?
It's a hell of a story. It's a hell of a thing when we can't believe anything we hear anymore.
Yeah. We'll probably get breaking news that D.B. Cooper has teamed up with Amelia.
I think I heard that she visited her dentist just prior to the trip, and he had one of her teeth, and they were able to extract DNA from one of her teeth. And match it up. How about that?
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense.
It's done got so bad I can't believe my own stories.
As we know, over the years they've found all of these miscellaneous aircraft panels and various other things, but somehow they don't ever seem to match up. So those theories have, when it comes to the airplane, seem to have dissolved.
Now they're using DNA. I read in the paper the other day. They're using DNA
and
drawing a picture of a man's face.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
If that wasn't wild.
That's very, very wild.
It was in the St. Pete Times here, so who knows, you know.
Modern technology is tough to keep up with.
Big news.
It's terrible when you get to a point where you don't believe anything, though. It really is too bad.
Well, it's too bad
now we don't believe anything.
On their last leg going to Howland Island, when they had taken out some of that, they had that trailing HF antenna on a reel, and it was very heavy. And I guess Noonan supposedly had with Amelia's permission, they chopped it to save the weight so they could make it up in fuel. So if they had left it on there, it would have been a trade-off between communication or fuel, I guess. So I guess once they ran out of communication, they were kind of finished then.
Well, does anyone remember her last words recorded?
I can't say it on the air.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Okay. Not those words, John.
The other time you get in that situation.
We're on a line of 137-357.
What?
And does anyone know what that meant?
No.
That's a LOP between off of a radio somewhere.
No, that's the compass. That's the compass bearing 137. The reciprocal of 137 is 357. And
yeah,
that was a line on her compass. She was tracking.
But didn't know which way to turn, that way or this way.
I guess. But
seriously,
it was a bearing.
I mean, that was it. You didn't know if you're going away from it or from it or toward it.
No, she
didn't
know.
Have any way to cross check. Cross. You had to have a cross bearing.
And that's why she was trying to get in touch with that ship. And the ship, for some reason, lost communications with her. And,
right.
Of course, the rest is history.
She can go which way to turn.
Yeah.
That ship, was that the Itasca?
Itasca,
yes.
That's correct.
Right.
Yeah.
There also was in the AV Web magazine by Russ Niles that had a latest Earhart theory questioned. They said that the History Channel said in a statement it's exploring the latest development about Amelia Earhart and will be transparent in our findings. Ultimately, historical accuracy is most important to us and their viewers. The photo in question that was taken in the Marshall Islands and experts interviewed in the documentary pretty much concluded that two Caucasians in the picture were likely Earhart and Noonan. The blogger's claim hasn't been proven yet either, but he did supply a link to the Japanese government archives with the photo, and it is apparently dated 1935.
35?
Yes, 1935. No, 35 is the photo dated. So if it's 1935,
that's why I said it was prior
to
the flight.
It had to be before, right. So maybe it's authentic, but not of her death.
That's what I had heard,
too
the
early.
Same thing, yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they can't even find that Malaysia flight 370, 3 years ago.
They were just looking for it last year. They still couldn't find anything. They gave it up.
Yeah, but they think it's down in really deep water, and a lot of the stuff they have can't go that deep.
It's interesting.
Well,
it was strange that they had somebody, trying to remember, they had a piece of a flap with a serial number on it and a part number, and they said it was off of that airplane. And they didn't hear anything
about
that. You heard after that.
Yes, there was more about it. The thing is that flap was pretty much intact. If it had run out of gas and went into a dive and hit the ocean at a high speed, that flap would have been in a million pieces. So the fact that it was pretty much intact means that the airplane probably hit in a softer, like a flat water ditching, as opposed to a high-speed dive. So the flap really meant something, the fact that it was complete. It wasn't torn up.
Yeah. We haven't heard anything more on that. It's, unless I missed it myself, but still seems
to
be another mystery.
Well, the company that was doing this last outfit to go down there, they pretty much guaranteed they'd find it within X number of months. And a few weeks ago, they gave up and said they couldn't find it.
You know, the three mysteries we know of Amelia's, we're still trying to find that out, but also D.B. Cooper, it seems like they found D.B. Cooper. And the mystery I'd like to see cleared is what happened to Flight 985 when it crashed into Mount Illimani.
Yeah.
You and me both. It was 980.
Well, George is working on that.
Yeah, he is.
I think the plane was blown up.
Yeah, those
they
are
found
the great mysteries.
A lot of this down low in a lower altitude than when they originally went.
So a lot of the stuff was brought down by glaciers from the higher altitudes and torn up, but it came out. You know, they found parts of clothing, parts of radios. They found some tape they thought might have been a flight recorder, but it wasn't a tape flight recorder. It was, I guess, digital or something.
Well, we found a tape, but the tape was so bad that they couldn't get anything off of it.
Yeah,
but well, we don't really know if that's true or not. I mean, maybe they don't want to release some things either.
Let's
they
hold
really
that discussion for another show. I think we'll do another show on Mount Illimani.
All right.
Right now, that was a great discussion, folks, about Amelia and Fred Noonan's disappearance. But I'd like to hear another story that Jim Holder may have thought up. And
I didn't think it up. It really happened.
Okay. This is not fake news. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, what a, you really got a great introduction to me.
I know.
This story,
I can only do it with
you know, I told you, Neil, that I've told a lot of stories in this show, and it just kills me if I tell the same story again. But I'm quite positive I haven't told this story. And it's a true story, in spite of what you said. And it's apropos because since Ryanair over in Europe made that emergency descent, they showed all the pictures of people with an oxygen mask on and everything else. Well, I got a story about the same thing. And I was a captain, but it wasn't an emergency. And this happened a long time ago, obviously, if I was a captain on an Eastern 727, but it was from Atlanta to Orlando. And that particular morning, there was a squall line, and I don't mean a squall line puts it mildly. It was a gigantic squall line that went from the Atlantic across the northern part of Florida, the Georgia-Florida boundary, all the way to the west of the Florida Panhandle, except right there about in the middle, in the Florida-Georgia line, there was about a 50-mile a 30-mile, a 40-mile, I can't remember exactly what, break in the clouds. And it was completely clear. You could see the ground. The problem was that was the only way you could go from Florida north or north to Florida. Every airplane that day, including off of Control 1150, you know where that is, that's out over the Atlantic. The Control 1150 people, they had to come and come up through that 50, 40-mile hole in the storms that everybody was going through. And because of that, the people that were going through there and going to Chicago or coming from Chicago to Miami, they didn't have a problem. But I was going to Orlando. And Orlando wasn't that very far south of this space that we were going through. And I mean, there was airplanes. You could see airplanes going by north and south, up and up. Everybody, all these airplanes, everybody was going through that one little place. And they couldn't give us a descent. They said, Ethan, you're going to have to just stay up here at 33 or 35, whatever it was, I've forgotten. And we'll clear you on down, but you got all these people coming underneath you. You can't go down, you know, but you're going to Orlando, and we'll take care of you. Don't worry about it. We'll get you to Orlando. And finally, I was looking at Orlando, and I'm sitting up here at 33 or 35,000 feet, and I'm going to have to make what amounts to an emergency descent. So I got on the PA, and I told the folks that they were really lucky that today they were going to see a simulated emergency descent. Everything's fine. Don't worry about it. Everything's fine. But we're going to do what we would do if we lost the pressurization, just like Ryanair the other day. And I had everybody all excited about it, and I was telling them it's going to be more fun than you could believe, boy. It's like going to the circus or the fair or something like that. And I told the second officer to start bringing the cabin down as much as he could. And, Neil, you know you can bring the cabin down a little bit, but you got to keep the differential. And so finally they gave us the clearance to start down, and I swear we were about 35 miles from Orlando. So I told them I'm going to I'm going to pull the speed brakes. We're going to pull the engines back. You know, you got to keep the engines up a little bit to keep the pressurization. We're going to pull them back as much as we can, but I got a super second officer here. He's going to keep this cabin pressurized, but it's going to be coming down a little bit on the fast side, so be ready for it. Hold your nose, close your mouth, and blow whatever you got to do. But it's going to be fun, folks. And so they cleared us down, and so I rolled into about a 20-degree left bank, pulled the speed brake, and down we started. And, I mean, we were coming down. I'd say we were pretty close to 20 degrees nose down, and that don't
but
sound like much. But if you're in an airplane, it's a lot. And we were coming down, and every 5,000 feet, I'd say, hey, we just went through 30,000 feet. Everybody hollered. I said, hey, we just went through 25,000 feet. Now we're down to 20,000 feet. You know? And we're coming down like a rock, and the people back there are just having a ball. It's like being on a Ferris wheel or something. I don't know. And we leveled off at about 10, and we were right over the airport. We had to make a 360 to get down to land. And when the passengers got off, they said, that's the most fun we've ever had on an airplane. And these people on Ryanair talking about they were bleeding and ears popping and crazy.
Oh, my God.
These people thought it was fun. And I had about, 150 people back there. They thought this was the greatest thing that ever happened to them.
Hey, Jim.
On the clacker, all the way down, huh?
Yeah.
No, I'm on the clacker. We were right below the clacker.
I'm going to edge in here, Jim Holder.
I'm going to get down, not go fast. But that's a true story.
I'm going to edge myself in here. I had one just like that, except we lost pressurization. I could not do my story to make people laugh like you have, so I'm just going to not tell my story tonight, but I have told it on the air once before, long time ago. But it is exciting.
I got one myself.
A rapid descent on the emergency checklist.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it was in the 727 as well.
Well, there you go.
Okay, that was a great story, Jim.
Didn't have a nifty count. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you. Maybe
well,
the last
listen
one
to this.
Now,
stick around. I want you to hear this. I want everybody to hear this because Dorothy's going to tell us about it.
Did not hear it, the EAL radio show plays the Big Band Era. You missed quite a show. You can listen to the first big band in the series we expect to play in the coming months by going to the archive and clicking on Episode 9 of the Old Time Radio series. How about coming along with us and swing to the Tommy Dorsey Band July 26th at 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. It was really a great show. Don and Neil were on, and Neil played all these fabulous Glenn Miller songs, and it was very, very good. I mean, I was practically dancing in the office. I couldn't stay still because each one was just terrific to hear. But then he told a story about Eastern Airlines at that particular time. So, folks, you need to stand by, watch it every other, or listen to it every other Thursday. We have the next one, as I said, Tommy Dorsey, and that's going to be followed again in 2 weeks later with the Big Band Era of Denny Goodman. And then Neil has some other ones that are coming up, like Harry James and Duke Ellington. So be sure to catch us on there. Of course, we have From the Eastern Files on the other Thursday, which has been a great hit, too. So please do so. You owe yourself to listen to it. Just go to our blog talk radio and tune it in, episode 9. I also want to mention that we had a couple of emails. We're getting ready for the 36th Street training in the villas there, and we have some people who have responded. We have Derek Duke, who plans to be on with us, and Emma Fritchie. So anyone that wants to do so, please send an email to host@ealradioshow.com and let us know that you'd like to join us and leave us your telephone number, and that would be great. We'd love to hear more people. Don't forget also we have the Eastern Airline Brat Facebook, and we encourage everyone to go there on Facebook if you're a Facebook user and sign up and talk with all the people there that are Eastern Brats. We also want to mention that we have the 48th Annual REPA Convention coming up at the Francis Marion Hotel September 4th to September 7th, and we have the REPA online has registration and instructions to download. You could get it from the repartee if you get that issue. I had another email that came in. It was from a Jack Sanders of the Ridgefield, Connecticut Press. He had written an article on the Flight 853 hijacking. We didn't have his name on the website, didn't know that he had a copyright on it. So he wrote in today, and I have that listed with his name on there. So we do apologize to Jack Sanders. I have written him about it, and we have put that information up on our website. It's under the Memories of Memorials. So please check that out anytime, too. We have breaking news that we'll put up there. I've changed the format on the front page. You'll notice that it's just listing the four headlines that we have each week, and it will be like that with the inside under the newsletter Jan-June, where you'll actually see the whole article on it. We have the upcoming radio series next week on Monday evening. We're going to have, as Neil mentioned previously, Captain Valera Kudukov, the retired Aeroflot Airlines pilot. And following that, we'll have an episode on Eastern history set to music. So we have a lot of things coming up, a lot of great, interesting programs. So please stay tuned on Monday and on Thursdays. We'd love to have our Eastern family join us. Back to you, Neil.
Eastern Flight 374, you're clear to land on runway 27 right. Winds are calm. If you could make the first turnoff, I certainly would appreciate it. We have reports of an animal carcass at the far end of the runway.
Tower, Eastern 374 declared emergency. We just lost hydraulic system B, which fires our brakes. We're going to need the entire runways. We'll be using the reverse thrust to purge the air tank to power those brakes. So tell us how far we rolled. So get that animal off the runway. Until you tell us that, we're going to hold at the outer marker 27 right-hand turn until the runway is clear. We got 141 passengers, 7 crew members, and 1 jump seat rider for a total of 149 souls on board. Over.
Roger, you're clear to land, Eastern 374.
All right, we're bringing it in. We're bringing it in.
Monday at 7 p.m. when Eastern Flight 375, America's favorite way to fly, takes off for another wonderful Eastern adventure. That's our show for tonight, folks. We thank all participating in tonight's broadcast and especially our listeners. With this, we take a line from the stories of Lake Wobegon, where all the Eastern women are unequaled, all the Eastern men are good-looking, and all the Eastern children and Eastern grandchildren are way above average, and they're not brats at all. Until then, we say good night, Eastern family. We love you, Eastern.
Good night, Eastern. We love you.
Good night.
Good night, everyone. Thank you for being with us.